Film Method is a Tsunami production. Brought to you in part by Tidal Broadcasting and Momentum Creative Studios, designing forward. This is Film Method.
Welcome to the Film Method Podcast, Pod Show.
Woohoo!
Pod Show, right?
Yes, Pod Show.
This is Cindy Freeman and...
Jenna Edwards.
The lovely Jenna Edwards and...
Linda Lopez.
The lovely Linda Lopez. She was little distracted right then because, well, she's busy. She's our engineer slash producer.
Slash amazingness.
Aw, thank you guys. I love Film Method.
All of those things. And Jenna is our amazing co-host and she's also a producer.
Yes.
Linda helps produce the podcast and Jenna produces a number of other things.
I produce life.
Yes, she produces her life.
Actually, wait, makes it sound like you make babies.
Yeah, I know. I'm opposite of that. Yes, okay. We were talking about that today.
Well, we are very excited to be in the midst of season 4. Oh my goodness.
This
is the season
about
post-production. We're combining post-production with marketing and distribution. We're going to kind of just throw it all in there
together. What do you do when your movie's shot?
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about. To help us speak to this subject today is the lovely Orly Ravid. Hello, Orly.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Orly.
Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's so professional. It's amazing.
Well, we like to think
Wow.
so. Thank you for thinking so.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
See, she said it's professional.
I know.
And Orly wouldn't lie.
Orly wouldn't lie to us.
Orly wouldn't lie.
Not right now. Maybe later on.
My name means don't lie.
Oh, well,
in French and Israeli.
Exactly.
Maybe not.
Orly is a film sales agent, correct?
In a way, a manner of speaking, but not entirely. But we'll get into that.
So there was some lying. Yeah, I didn't lie.
That's Sherry Candler, not me.
Sherry.
Hi, Sherry Candler. Thanks for sending us Orly.
Yes, we're very appreciative. Tell us a little bit about yourself for the listeners, Orly.
Sure. I founded and co-run a nonprofit organization called the Film Collaborative, which is focused on film distribution. So in that, through that organization, we do work with films, and sometimes we, quote unquote, you know, sell them or get involved in the licensing side. We do lots of that. And I do have a background in film sales, definitely. The Film Collaborative, I wouldn't call a sales agent per se, because we, A, don't take rights, and B, function very differently from the typical sales agent. And we also do a lot of other things. We do theatrical distribution. We do direct digital distribution. We do grassroots marketing. We do a lot of educational work, including having come up with this book called Selling Your Film Without Selling Your Soul. So
that's such a great title.
That is really great.
Thank you so much. Well, you know, it took a little bit of getting to get there. I mean, we had a lot of really interesting titles ranging from academic to like crazy. And we finally were like, you know, we can't just rely on ourselves. We just survey monkeyed it and the people spoke. So
nice.
But, you know, the Film Collaborative is honestly first and foremost an educational organization to help filmmakers, you know, figure it out. And then we can also facilitate. And we do.
Lovely. Well, could you take us back a little bit and just tell us about how you got into the film business? And you said that you were a sales agent, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you were a sales agent, what does that mean? I mean, what did that look like and what kind of things were you responsible for?
No, for sure. I mean, I've been in the business about 12 years. My very first intersection with the business was on the festival programming side. And I took a stab at writing, all that kind of stuff, creative stuff. When I came to Los Angeles from New York, I first worked with a festival and then fell into distribution through an international sales agent.
Wow.
And that company, it's funny because they had done very, very well in the 80s and then sort of predicted that things would shift a little bit in the film business. And the Asia crisis had come about as well. So anyway, I ended up launching a domestic distribution arm, but I started out doing the foreign sales, then did domestic distribution, then worked for a production company that produced the others. And then had my own consulting business. And then again, went to work for Senator Distribution, which was a foreign sales company, and then also launched a domestic distribution. So I've kind of
I'm tired. I need to leave.
I know. I was going to say, and I just, because like I can talk a lot about foreign sales for sure, but I've also been an acquisitions executive and done a lot of domestic distribution too.
Great.
Oh my goodness.
That's going to make this episode amazing because we usually talk to, you know, newer filmmakers. So we would love to jump right into the questions. Cindy has a great list of questions for you.
I do, actually. I'm Excellent. Not entirely responsible for this list of questions. I'm going to give another shout out to Sherry Candler because she's obviously much more well-versed in this area than I am or than any of us are, really. Jenna has some experience in this realm. But I guess, so if you could maybe, I know you explained to us a lot of things that you did, but maybe if we can just go back to the question of, what does a sales agent do? Mm-hmm. And maybe kind of focus on the world of independent filmmaking.
Yeah, of course. I mean, well, so there are, if you're a U.S. filmmaker, there are typically, you see two categories of sales agents, a domestic one that's focusing on U.S. and North American sales, and another kind of company that will focus on worldwide sales. And sometimes a worldwide company will handle everything. Those companies, not all of them take rights, but the majority do. So the first thing is they take the rights to then represent and resell the rights. And how they do that is they go to a number of key markets, film markets, things like Cannes and Berlin and, you know, places like that. And there's other ones too. And just some of them are focused more on television markets. Some of them are more focused on theatrical, and some of them are a full hodgepodge. Some are much more documentary focused. Some are, you know, action films and thrillers and genre stuff. And so different companies have their different flavors.
Now, I'm going to interrupt really quick just clarify. And I'll probably do this, just warning you. But just to clarify, when you say television, you mean like made for TV movies, correct?
No, actually, I didn't mean that. I mean, for example, documentaries. Of course, some documentaries sell for theatrical distribution and, you know, or do all rights deals. But a lot of documentaries really are mostly successful in doing television deals.
But you're not talking about television series is what
I'm
saying.
No, I'm talking about, you know, independent narrative. I'm sorry, independent films that are selling for to television stations around the world.
Correct.
In the Netherlands, in Israel, you know, in the U.S., And documentaries actually is a great example of a category of a strand of independent cinema that typically does more business that way in distribution than in other ways. In fact, a lot of times documentary filmmakers will make two versions of their film, one that's sort of 90 minutes and one that's a TV hour, like 52 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So sales agents, there's companies that focus on different kinds of cinema and other companies that focus on a whole range. And they are, but because it's an expensive thing to go to markets, it's not free. Like, you've got to travel, you've got to have an office, you've got to take meetings, you've got to have materials. They basically pick a bunch of films and then represent them to buyers and decide, you know, which kind of markets they're going to focus on, and that sort of dictate, or vice versa, based on the films, and they decide which markets to go to. For example, if you have a bunch of films that are good for TV, you're going to go to a TV market like MIPTV.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, and that's what happened. And they sell the rights to distributors around the world, and they sell them for certain territory based on territories and for terms, which are the length of time, and for different categories of rights. Okay. So that's the basics.
Wow. It's a lot.
That's a lot.
We can talk a lot more about that. But.
Right. So if you are, so obviously, like, if you're a filmmaker, then you have to just know what your market is before you even start making. I mean, obviously, you can't make, well, I guess you could. I mean, like you're saying, like, documentary makers, filmmakers will make two versions. Are they making two versions at the onset, do you think? Or once they start taking their film around and seeing, like, where the interest is, maybe they'll, like, recut a version? I mean, what do you know about that?
I think it happens all different ways. And, you know, you're asking a great question, because I think the first thing a filmmaker should do is sort of educate him or herself about the potential of a film and sort of think about where they fit in the scheme of life. You know, a lot of times filmmakers just make the damn thing and then they figure it out later. And that can be costly. That can be a costly mistake. I think some films feel more theatrical than others. Some really feel perfect for television.
Yeah.
Some films are really in between. And I think, you know, it really is a case by case basis. some films are so American specific that they may not travel well.
Right.
You know, or vice versa. The film could be made in Europe or in Africa or the Middle East and be so specific that it really won't travel well. So that there's that too. And then there's a question of budget. You know, if you have the money and the time to make two versions of your film, great. Mm-hmm. If you don't, you just do what you do. And then you get into a festival or hopefully get into good festivals and see what happens. And then, you know, if your film is strong enough and if it's got enough accolades, then you'll get the money to do the editing, or sometimes a TV station will even pay you money to do the editing. I mean, some TV stations do sometimes give money to do cut downs, like PBS does that sometimes, Arte, which is a French German broadcaster.
Did you work more with feature films, or did you have some experience in the TV world as well?
Well, I've never worked in television per se. I've worked with film with a range of films, narrative and docs.
Okay.
You know, more commercial and definitely less commercial.
Okay. But not really the television. It seems like a whole different world, maybe.
Yeah, it is. Okay. I mean, and there's an intersection only in that a lot of, you know, some of the key markets happen in the city of Cannes in France. But it's a different class of people doing the business, you know,
right.
Different buyers, different sellers, different product, different everything.
Yeah. It seems like, I mean, you said a different product. It seems like it's not an easy crossover if you're a sales agent. I mean, maybe, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but.
No, it's a whole different, you know, the whole thing with sales is it's about contacts. It's funny. I was just talking with somebody that we work with on the foreign sales side, and, you know, TV buyers come to buy a bulk, like they come, it's like a wholesale thing. They're coming to buy a lot of stuff because they have a 24/7 entity to program.
Got it.
As opposed to distributors who are first focused on films that can perform theatrically. Well, they do, you know, 5, 12, 20 films a year, whatever they do. They're not buying 24/7 content.
Right, right. It's very different in that way. How do sales agents decide on projects that they will represent?
I think it's the question of their business model. I mean, there's some companies that are really focused on commercial cinema, period, the end of story. Mm-hmm. Maybe every now and again, they'll take something that has festival flavor with it, you know. and then there are companies that are just purely docs, like Films Transit, you know, Rocco Films, Ketley Clef's company. I mean, those companies are focused just on documentary cinema. You know, yeah, it is best to be focused because it's a big, you know, there's a lot of different places to go to do the sales, and you cannot be traveling, you know, every day all year long. So, you know, you kind of pick your poison, as it were. And
right.
And then there's some very big companies that, you know, have bigger films with cast, and, you know, Wild Bunch is an example of a company that does have a great range. They've been so successful with some very big films that they can also take the tiny little Iranian film that, you know, has, you know, quote unquote, no commercial potential. However, then they get it into Cannes Film Festival, and actually it sells to 30 countries because it just gets critical acclaim and whatever, and Wild Bunch is selling it.
I have a question that adds on to that, and it is, how do you, as an independent filmmaker, maybe find these focused distribution companies when they're smaller, but they're still more tailored towards what you're looking for? Like, you just mentioned a bunch of documentary companies that, you know, maybe a new documentary filmmaker might not know how to find a listing. Is there a place that lists them?
Yeah, there's, well, first of all, you said the word distributor, and these companies, and I just, it's important for me to interrupt and say they're not distributors, they're sales companies. They don't do distribution almost ever, meaning they almost never do it. They almost always just simply reselling rights to distributors. So the first question is, should you work with a company like that? Is your film one that will, because I have to tell you, I get approached by filmmakers all the time looking to sell their film worldwide when that's just never going to happen. You know, their film is not that kind of film. And so the first thing is to figure out, have you made that kind of film? And what does that mean? Like, is it worth your time and money to go to a sales agent to then sell your film when the deals will be so small that you actually might be better off doing a lot more direct distribution? Mm. And I think that's a really important thing. But then if you do have a film that, you know, is going to sell to TV stations around the world or to bigger distributors where there is enough money up front or the deals are good enough where that's worth your while, you know, AFM will have a buyer's guide and a seller's guide, Toronto International. If you're registered for any one of those festivals or markets, Sundance has an industry guide. You know, any festival or market that's of any value. If you're registered, you'll get this wonderful contact stuff, you know, information. And then, you know, gosh, I mean, we have what's called a distributor report card on our site, which is sort of a Yelp for film distribution where people can comment on their experiences. And that includes a lot of different sales companies. And then you just ask people, right? I mean, I think if you're a filmmaker who made a film and you want to figure out what to do, the first thing you should do is think, okay, my film fits into this kind of category and this one. And that's sort of like these seven films that I can think of. So let me call those filmmakers and see what they did, and what happened. And let me talk to people who, you know, because the one thing I will caution is if you go to a sales agent who's not a distributor, but they will take all your rights, and all of a sudden, if they can't make the sale, they're sitting on your film and you can't do anything with it either. And
they've bought the rights.
Yeah, they have the rights.
And
they've bought, whether they actually paid you money or they just did a deal with you for no money up front. It can be either way. And then all of a sudden they've got a fat library of films and they're just going to dump onto digital platforms around the world. And you just have another middleman in the middle of your revenue and no control. And who knows if you ever see the overages. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. But also they're not necessarily doing anything you couldn't have done for yourself through many different other channels. Right. So you got to be careful because, I mean, the companies I mentioned are all known and reputable and good companies. And I think that we are good at what we do. I should say, you know, when we do deals for filmmakers, the deal is between the buyer and the filmmaker. We're not in the middle of the money. The filmmakers to pay us. So the big thing to figure out with an international sales company is, because, you know, in our book, I mean, there are filmmakers who've done those deals with sales agents where the sales agent made money, but the filmmaker didn't.
Mm-hmm. That's very common.
Yeah, it's such an old story. So you've got to ask like 10 people about the company, people who've actually worked with the company. Did you get paid? And you've got to think it through and run the numbers.
And most of the time I've noticed filmmakers are very happy to share their experiences. And so I think like for the newer filmmakers out there who haven't maybe had the chance to network as much as we have, don't be afraid. You know, most people have their emails listed on IMDb or the social networking sites. Just send an email and they're happy to say, well, here's what, you know, happened to us. And you have to be, I think, willing to look at it very critically and without negative judgment. Like if I said, well, I didn't make any money from that company, what was the circumstances surrounding that? You know, has my film been out a month? Well, of course I'm not making any money because it's been out a month. So make sure when you are asking those questions that you understand the parameters of the answers.
And then, like, for example, it could have been that they paid you such a huge amount of money up front, you never made money beyond that. I mean,
correct.
That doesn't happen all the time. But, you know, I think you're absolutely correct in what you're suggesting. And I'll bring up an anecdote because we were working with a film called Midnight Sun, which is a very, you know, artsy horror film. So kind of an interesting blend of genre and art house, super small independent film. And you know, we do foreign sales, but genre stuff is not our strong suit. So I was willing to do the sales for him if we had to, but I felt that he'd be better served with other companies. I tell you, I went from meeting to meeting with international sales companies, all of whom were so lovely in the room. And, you know, I would have been like, yeah, sure, okay. I'm you know, I mean, as jaded as I am, I'm also trusting, you know. And sure enough, though, oh, my God. It was horrifying.
Wow.
When we actually called, it was really depressing, actually, because it's sad, and we're still going through the last few more, but it's like really sad.
Yeah.
And there's no recourse. You have to realize if the company is not based in the United States, who are you going to sue? What are you going to do?
Right. Well, and just like we always say here on Film Method, you know, read your contracts and do your research in pre-production and in production. You have to do the same, if not more, research when you get into distribution and you have to do more contract reading and make sure you understand what you're reading because it's not something you can just gloss over. They're not standard, even if they say they're standard. And
there's no standard. I mean,
exactly.
Unless you're using an IFTA contract, it's not
what
standardized.
Is that?
The International Film and Television Association. I used to be AFMA. I always forget exactly what it stands for. But it's funny you bring that up because I'm going to say that I'm doing tips for the Sundance Artist Services to educate their filmmakers about digital distribution. And even the term video on demand and VOD means entirely different things in different contracts.
So true.
And people, I guarantee you most filmmakers are not
completely they're not reading the terms and section not, or, of the contracts.
Yeah, they're not, and they're not real. I saw contracts where one term referred to another term, referred to another term, referred to another term. Mm. You know, and they're not doing that careful. And maybe they have a good attorney, or maybe they just have an attorney who's good at what he or she does, but isn't experienced in distribution. And that yes. that you might as well not even have an attorney looking at it. No, no offense, but it's
no,
really
it's true.
It's really about knowing the business models and the way monetization is happening in the business today, not 10 years ago, you know, today, and anticipating the future as well, especially in with new technology. We're slightly digressing, but you, what you said is so correct. And I'd also say your contract is only as good as your ability to enforce it. Again,
it's true.
You know, you're really you're really not going to sit there and go to Germany or go to wherever. Just you're not going to be able to.
Well, and I mean, if you're a filmmaker with limited means and you sign a contract, I mean, yeah, you can sue them. Do you have the time and money to do it? That's a question you have to ask yourself, even if they're here.
And is your contract, what is the provision for that in your contract? At least, you know, have an arbitration provision that is sensible based on your means and your needs,
exactly.
which is, are different for different filmmakers.
Exactly. I mean, as we're going into the season of distribution and what to do after you've shot your film, you know, it's really important for me to get the listeners to understand this is the part where you are more responsible. You know, you can't be like, oh yeah, they took me for a ride. When you're hearing from people who have the experience saying you will get taken for a ride if you don't read your contracts. I mean, that's just like one way for you to maybe stop that ride from happening a little bit more. But yeah, so please, I beg you, read your contracts. Over and
I want to
ask
you, just being, I mean, this is a topic I know almost nothing about. And what I do know about it is because of my experience working with Jenna in a film that she did. And that's, again, very little. But so I'm going to ask you some very newbie questions. Like, when you're a sales agent, are you working independently? Are you working for a bigger company? What does that look like? Or are there different scenarios there?
And by you just mean one, anybody, a person.
Yeah, like when you were a sales agent.
No, I worked for a company, and presently, well, I work for my own company.
Right.
But there are producers reps who sort of function as sales agents, and usually they're standalone individuals, although they might have a company name associated with themselves. But most of the time, these are bigger companies. Well, a bunch in UGC and, you know, Hanway and Fortissimo, and I can just go on and on and on and list them all. Celluloid Dreams. These are people, these are companies with true offices and staff, and their booths in Cannes and Berlin at EFM, which is European Film Market in Berlin, are, you know, real booths with real, you know, real stuff going on.
Okay.
So, and even we actually, the way we do it, just to be clear, is the Film Collaborative, being a nonprofit, can't afford to travel around the world all the time. I go every month, I'm away somewhere. But even that, with that, so I work with Errol Veneziano of Recreation Media, and he used to head up Icon International and Alliance Atlantis. All these these are also very big companies, and he has his own boutique firm now, and that's how we handle it. It's like there's a lot of deals that I can do from our office in Los Angeles, and then there's other kinds of deals like going to MIP Television in Cannes, where you kind of want to have some other people also, you know, doing that for you. Like, meaning I, instead of me having to go myself, just all by myself, we work with him and he covers it for us.
Would you suggest that filmmakers go with somebody that's kind of working for a bigger company or somebody that's working for a more of a boutique company, or does it matter?
I think matters is A, that you're with a company that is right for your kind of film, that they have the personality as a company and as the individuals to know how to, that are passionate for your film and know how to sell your film. They have a history and a track record with the buyers, because half the thing is the collections. You know, I mean, like, that's the other reason I'm working with Ariel, because I have a history with certain kinds of buyers, but not with all kinds of buyers.
Okay.
And that's the most important thing. And that's why I, with Midnight Sun, like, we wanted to find somebody else, because I don't have a history with the horror buyers. And collecting is the big battle. So, you know, you need companies with the right fit and with the muscle. And at the same time, you know, you need, the bigger companies are also going to be possibly less flexible, and they'll recoup more expenses if you're not careful. I mean, you know, the parties in Cannes are being paid for by the filmmakers of the films. That's, you know, and you got to realize, and I mean, I'm not going to name names, but I'm telling you, I have seen accounting from some of the companies that whose names I have mentioned, where it is messed up, where it is just messed up because every dollar is being recouped and it's for crazy stuff. And you know what? It might be glamorous and it might be fun and you might be proud of it. But if you need to make money back for your investors or yourself, it's not good fiscal policy. You know?
I think it's important to kind of add on to what you were saying, the right fit. I feel like filmmakers, especially when they have their first film or even their second film, they're so excited if someone's interested. If someone's interested, someone else is going to be interested. So don't take the deal just because you feel like you have to. You definitely want to work with people who are wanting to work with you, because otherwise
you're... Kind of like a job interview.
You
don't want to just get so excited at that first interview when they're like, oh, we really like you and we can offer you this and that.
It's then they're going to be like, here's $5 an hour.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing. They have nothing to lose.
Exactly.
Nothing to lose. They have your master. They'll have all your deliverables. They'll have your rights. So it's for them, the more the merrier. So really, that's why. And then the other thing is there's a lot of deals out there that are like a couple $1,000 a territory. And by territory, I mean, it's French speaking Europe, it's German speaking Europe, it's Taiwan, it's Mexico, you don't necessarily need somebody to be in the middle of $2,000 for a handful of territories. Maybe if that's the business that's going to go down, you might be better off building a brand for yourself worldwide and being available on digital platforms worldwide and back-ending your own site and just being in control. And I'll tell you, with Adventures of Power, which was a film at Sundance with Jane Lynch and Adrien Grenier, and it's in our book, he had a sales agent, and we just wrote that sales agent termination letter. So we've just ended that arrangement for him. Because the sales agent made money. The William Morris agency made money for connecting him to the sales agent. They talk about layers of middlemen. And everybody made money. The filmmaker made between $2,000 and $3,000 total.
Whoa.
From his worldwide sales effort.
Oh my,
discovered that of his 100,000 Facebook fans, half of them were in Mexico. So we connected him with Distrify, a DIY platform, so he can sell his film to the consumers in Mexico who are interested in his film directly. And so I'm not trashing the business of international sales, because I participate. Well, A, I'm not trashing it. No, because it can be the case that there are good deals.
Oh, absolutely.
We have a film called Weekend that won at South by Southwest, and we're doing international sales. And there are countries around the world that are going to have theatrical release for the film, and there's real money being made, and it's good for the filmmaker's career and all this stuff, or those companies I mentioned earlier, they'll do TV deals for a film, and all that stuff can be, significantly better than not.
Which is why what you were saying earlier is you have to know what your film is and where it's going to fit the best, right? Because if you have a film that is not, I don't want to say worthy, but is not the type of film that is going to do what you just said, which is theatrical, overseas, this big giant distribution or release, that's okay. And I feel like filmmakers get upset and offended by that, but it's like you have to be realistic or you're just going to make no money. And if that's your case, that's okay too, but whatever your expectations are, know them and manage them, and I think find the
and
deal
vet
them. That's
vet
going
your own
to...
expectations, right? It's like,
right.
What are my expectations? Why are they my expectations? Are they grounded? But also
are they grounded? That's a really good question.
I am mentally competent. No, I'm kidding.
No, or you wouldn't have made that movie.
Oh, yeah, she said that. I didn't say that.
Well, I mean, just any movie.
That's true. We're a little crazy,
right?
Let's be honest.
Yeah, no, exactly. Just in a good way, right?
Yes.
In the very best way, for sure. No, but obviously. But on the contract side, I would say also think through the things you want to protect yourself from in the contract. In other words, not just read the document they send you, but think, okay, so Mr. Sales Agent or Ms. Sales Agent, I asked you to give me projections. So if you don't meet your projections in a period of a year, how about we cancel this deal? How about for any territory you don't sell within a year, I get back the distribution rights to do direct digital? How about, I like to do hybrid solutions because, it isn't like it's easy to market your film around the world. It isn't. And it isn't like DIY can do everything for you all the time in every country around the world. I mean, I think DIY in the United States can be amazing.
Yes.
And can often be much more productive and, you know, and revenue generating and holistically, you know, useful. But, you know, it's hard to do it around the world if you're not a big brand. It's one thing to be Banksy, you know, worldwide art brand. You know, I'm sure, Exit Through a Gift Shop, you know, that's a great example of a film that can do well around the world.
Was that because of grassroots marketing?
It's because he's famous.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because he's, I love that you're just like, said that. It's yeah. Like, no, you have. You're famous. Let's figure out how to use that.
Because an art collector paid $750,000 for the rights to his film for France. Because that didn't come from any efforts on behalf of anybody. That came from the artist's existence and fame. And, of course, being at Sundance always helps. I mean, there is that. You know, if you premiered at a B-level festival and you've only done B-level festivals since, you may have a harder time than the film that premiered at an A-level festival because those festivals have a brand that, you know, I think that's the other thing that's important for filmmakers. It's also like, know who you are. Are you building a brand for yourself as a filmmaker? Are there brands in your film? Like, you know, Note by Note, which is a film that John Reese covered in our book. That's about the Steinway piano. Like, that's a brand. You know, that's good. You know, Revenge Electric Car that, you know, we've been working with, you know, they're films that they're in and of themselves are their own brands or have their own brands that connect up to audience interest or genre films that just like, you know, but if you're not, you got to know, like, am I a filmmaker who's working on building my own brand such that it's better that I continue to develop and cultivate an audience and build an audience ahead of time. And, you know, the more you do, you know, anyway, but we're going a little bit off topic now on the sales side, but I think that that's part of it. It's like, you might not be that filmmaker, in which case, you know, if there's no hook in your film and no hook to your brand, well, then the question is who what's your audience?
Right.
Now, and don't say everyone.
Yeah.
Because it's not true.
Yeah.
Of almost any film in the universe. Harry Potter might be one of the few films that actually, you know,
delivers across the
board. And then there's some others, but they're very few.
Right. James Cameron movies generally do, I would think. He's pretty famous.
And pretty rich.
Yeah. When you were talking about negotiating, or, you know, like, okay, well, how about if the projections don't, you know, come true in a year, then, you know, we get these rights back. Should the filmmaker bring their attorney to have that negotiation or a conversation? Who's doing that negotiation for the filmmaker?
Well, it's up to them. I mean,
who do you recommend?
Well, I recommend that they either work with an attorney who knows the business and who isn't overcharging them, or they work with a company like us. We do legal services and contract services with attorneys, not just out of my head. But, you know, the bottom line is you can also get screwed over by an attorney overbilling you for, you know, mediocre services and not knowing what they're doing. I mean, I was just on the phone with my mother today. We were like lamenting some crackpot attorney. So, you know, I'm just saying, like, be smart about it. Yes. Don't do it yourself unless you really know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, get an entity, whoever it is, who knows what they're doing, who understands distribution contracts and the business. It's not about, again, especially when it's outside the United States, it really isn't about legal issues, I promise you. It's about definitions of rights, and it's about, yes, it's about your legal recourse, but again, your contract is only as good as your ability to enforce it. So if your lawyer has built in all these wonderful provisions that you will never be able to enforce, it doesn't matter.
Well, not only that, I'd like to add to that, have a lawyer who can explain it to you so that you understand it. If you're not versed in contract reading and you don't understand what you're looking at, and your lawyer can't explain it to you, it's going to be an issue because you down the road are the one that's going to know when someone's in breach of that contract. No one else is going to be paying attention for you. So that's my suggestion, is to make sure that you understand the contract.
I think that that's correct. But I strongly suggest that, regardless of who you work with on the legal side, that you make sure you're working with people who know the business side.
Yes, it's true.
You know, because it's about the deal terms.
Right. Now, we can kind of transition a little bit from, like, you kind of described what a typical sales agent will do, or what you did as a typical sales agent. Now, let's talk about Film Collaborative and what services you provide and kind of what your mantra is as far as helping filmmakers. What is your mantra?
Well, our tagline is filmmakers first, and we don't own your rights, you do.
Love it.
Those are two taglines.
It's a great group that mm-hmm. you started.
Thank you so much.
I'm really proud of that.
Oh, thank you. We're trying to bring the, years of experience to feel, so that it's not just like, oh, well wishing with like no clue. we're trying to, it's funny that this podcast is started out being focused on sales, because the truth is the whole collaborative was created because when I started in foreign sales and I went to Cannes, I thought this is one crazy business where people are monetizing secrecy. And everyone's making money because they know something somebody else doesn't know, meaning the client, right? They know the buyer that the client doesn't know. They know how to do it, the thing that, and that there was all this money. And I would look at these trade ads, and there's all this money being spent internally, business to business, when it could be spent better. It could be more efficient. Mm-hmm. It could be spent better targeting consumers who can then, support the work and support the filmmaker. So the Film Collaborative grew out of that sensation that I had, that there's something disgusting about that. That it was a lot of people eating way too much foie gras on the dime of the filmmaker. So we're trying to bring the distribution experience and know-how to filmmakers, but in a much more filmmaker-friendly way. And so mm-hmm. the way we do that is, the goal is really to be end-to-end. It doesn't mean you've got to do everything with us, but we can do every bit and every part. You want to do everything with us? Great. You want to work with 400 other companies? I don't care. We are a menu of services. It's a la carte or prefix. It doesn't matter. Your choice. But we do the foreign sales.
What was it? A la carte or prefix?
I don't know. I'm on a French kick today.
I was going to say, I thought it was prefixed.
It's like, you can either you can just have us do like, one thing or two things or three things or all of it. So yes, we do the international sales if you want us to. We'll do the domestic sales if you want us to. And obviously, if we feel like we can do it well, we can do the theatrical distribution. We can do the direct digital distribution. On that front, we do it, some of it directly and some of it with partners. And it because cable VOD is very complex and we cannot do all of it. I actually cannot do any of it directly yet. That'll come in time. But I bring that up because, funny, another contract thing, and this is where lawyers may or may not realize it, is not all cable VOD deals are the same. And not all services give you the same thing. But it looks like that. If you don't know it enough, you don't realize it. So all that stuff. And the educational, just to help filmmakers know what time it is, what's going on, how not to get hurt. Because I think that filmmakers just don't want to think about the business mm-hmm. and they feel like there's something dirty about having to think about it. But it's like, it's the most expensive art medium in the world. And, the funding is dying out. And so, you're going to have to be a little bit more connected to repaying either yourself or your investors for you to continue to work. And,
right.
That's our goal.
Now, give me like a situation where a filmmaker will come to you to hopefully take part in your services. And what's the vetting process, I guess?
That's a great question. We're getting a lot covered in this time.
Yes, we are.
Learning a lot.
You talk fast. I really like that. I have to say that. Yes. It's very efficient for the podcast. Thank you.
Exactly. Perfect. We have a lot more questions.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, okay. So the first thing is we'll educate anyone and everyone. We will not directly work with anyone and everyone. And so, first of all, some of it's free. There's a blog about distribution on the site that's free to everybody. There's like the digital distribution guide that is, accessible through the lowest level membership. There's the distributor report card that anyone can access, but you just have to get a password from us. And there's what's called the Collaborators, which is our Facebook for filmmakers, which is meant to network filmmakers so that they can they can sort of be vertically integrated, kind of like a studio, and inform each other, so they can ask each other the questions and get the information perspective. So all that stuff is free or super low cost. We're also a membership-driven organization. We're very, very inexpensive. The lowest is 100. The most expensive is 500 for for tons of servicing
per
either
year.
Way. It's $100 per year for the information access. And actually, mm-hmm. It was unlimited consultation for a full year at $350. And we raised it. Yeah. And I was going to have a nervous break. Well, I was going to have a nervous breakdown. So we, to avoid that mental health crisis, we raised it to $500 for half a year. So, you know, we did.
Still such a great, great value.
And I'm talking truly unlimited. Like, and by the way, I've never cut anybody's membership off. And, you know, I will never be like looking at the clock or looking at the month. It's not about that at all.
Right.
It's just a way to set some guidelines. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Got to have boundaries. Yeah. So that, you know, when you're budgeting your film, you know how much to put in that line item.
Mm-hmm. And so you can stay alive.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Like, because honestly, the $350 for a year was becoming like it was less than minimum wage. We're getting paid like for real. And, you know, it became hard to function, you know, if you're around the clock consulting and advising and you're like can't even, you know, anyway. So that's that. And then the decision making around, well, what do we do theatrically? What do we do? You know, all that stuff. That's a combination of the filmmaker's desire and our interest in working with the film and most of all ability to do it well. You know, not every film can sell well and certainly not through us. So there's that, you know, same thing with digital. So there's a vetting process and we are a nonprofit. We are focused not on commercial cinema. We're focused on films and filmmakers who have a cultural artistic mission and there's merit in that. So even the genre films that we have worked on, even the one that sold for, you know, a substantial six-figure sum. Even that had a historical theme and some cultural importance, and that's important to us because that's why we're doing this for such relative to the industry standard for less money.
Right. Is there a way that filmmakers can get involved working with you or start? I don't know if strike a deal is the right term, but will you consider distributing somebody's film in the pre-production phase, like if you see, or does it have to be completely finished?
No. I mean, the truth is, I recommend that you start thinking about all these things before you're finished, because the truth is you should be marketing your movie before it's finished, mm-hmm. and you should definitely be marketing your movie before it premieres at a festival. And I'll tell you, the biggest mistake I've seen is people not do that.
Yeah.
So for sure, and that's a great example of where the membership thing is not a hard and fast rule. Because if you sign up and you're like, but we're hardly working together for the first half a year because you're still, it's just a few questions here and there, I'm going to give you another half a year. You know what I mean? It's really, let me tell you something, nobody gets turned away. You know, we're here to help, truly.
Right, for consulting, but I mean for like distribution. Would
for
you?
All of it.
Okay.
We can't distribute a movie that doesn't exist, but.
But would you enter into some kind of agreement or deal with somebody?
I see. Well, I
pre-sales. Okay. You do pre-sales.
That was
okay,
it.
Okay, that's what you're looking for. Okay.
I don't know what it's called.
Something cryptic is going on here. I don't understand.
Sorry, just clicked in my head. No. I'm like, oh, right.
The thing.
I have to be honest. Pre-sales is something where if you don't have cast, the likelihood of it happening is so slim. You would have to be like, you know, something extraordinary. I mean, I'm open to doing business for a filmmaker if ever possible, but that's a tall order.
Okay. Good to know.
If I'm a filmmaker coming to you, what kind of filmmakers do you like to work with? Aside from content, the actual filmmakers.
The personality.
Yeah, what kind of filmmakers?
That's important.
I like to work with filmmakers who are, committed to being educated, you know, and passionate and committed to the work. I mean, not filmmakers who are doing it because they have some sort of vision of winning an Oscar, but a filmmaker who has to tell a story, who has to get a message out, filmmaker who's just creative and dedicated and diligent. I think, and the filmmakers in our book are all those folk, that kind of folk. And, you know, we do get the sort of like filmmaker who's, you know, trying it out here. You know, it's also become so trendy and, you know, and video cameras are so cheap and, you know, it's not like I don't want to help those folks. I'll help anybody. But if you're just sort of throwing spaghetti up against the wall and you're not serious and not committing, your film is not very strong, I'm not going to take it on for distribution.
Right. Because that doesn't do you any good. Because you have to have the support of the filmmaker while you're in the distribution process.
And the truth is, we're also a brand now. I mean, we're popular enough with filmmakers and we're known enough in the industry especially because we are doing, you know, the sales too. If we start to take on mediocre work, that's not good. Then everybody else will suffer.
By filmmakers who don't show up for the Q&As they're scheduled for.
Yeah, or just not committed. You know, honestly, I want a passionate artist. I'm passionate about what I do. I'm passionate about getting filmmakers the best deal possible, the best distribution possible, about, you know, monetizing transparency and being in it for the long haul, the long tail, not just a quick buck. And so I want to work with filmmakers who are the same way, but about the work, about the the production.
But that's with most anything, really. You want to work with and know like-minded people. Mm-hmm. You know,
I think we attract that, too, just because, like, we're called the collaborative, you know, and mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's working in that way.
So you don't get to work by yourself because it's in the title.
It's a collaborative collaboration.
Well, sorry.
Do you take on web series or are you primarily...
I've been asked to a bunch of times. It's not my wheelhouse. It's not that I'm against it. It's that I don't know enough about it. Mm. I got to be honest. So I know Sherry Candler in our book worked with Pioneer One and their web series. And her chapter is awesome and amazing. And I recommend reading it. I personally have a long way to go. Like, I just want to be clear about that. I'm green.
I love that you keep saying... I'm not going to take on a project that I'm not going to be able to do justice for is basically what I'm hearing from you. It's like, well, no, I don't have experience in that. Why would I take that on? You would be better off going over here. Do you find that amongst your peers, not at Film Collaborative, but in general with sales reps, we'll use that as a general term, with sales reps, that's why they turn away certain films? It's not always about the money, but it's about... If I can't distribute your film, well, I guess it is about the money, because if they can't distribute my film to the best of their ability, then, or the best of the film's ability, then the money's not going to come in. So
I think it's two things. I mean, I think their bottom line, they can't take on a project where they're not going to make money, and B, they don't want pissed off, angry filmmakers. It just, there's no upside for them. I will say, you know, when we refer another entity, we don't take a commission on that. So if we connect you up to a partner of ours or refer you to somebody, we do not take a commission for that ever, or get a referral fee or any of that stuff.
So there's no finder's fee type
thing.
No.
It's part of our educational work.
What's best for the project.
Yeah. And I think that is different. I mean, you know, I'm not saying we're like, you know, perfect and everyone else sucks. I'm just saying that. No, it's not
pretty
true.
Darn close.
No. And they're actually, interestingly, I'll say this. I think we're influencing people. I now hear that some sales companies are starting to change the way they're working a little bit. I think because, you know, it's going to be a game changer.
Yeah, definitely. And
that's why we're also careful with the brand. Because the better our brand is, the more we can do for the films. And the more power we have, the better for everybody.
Right. The more you can help filmmakers.
Well, and the more the standard changes. Because if we're amazing. A serious competitor... then everybody who's competing against, you know, in the space will have to adjust a little bit.
It's raising the standard.
I like it.
That's it's really what our goal is. And I think it's starting to happen little by little.
Yay.
Well, and the more educated the filmmakers in general are, the more the game changes.
Yeah.
You know, like if I'm going into, if 100 filmmakers are going in and saying the same thing to a Lionsgate, I've never worked with them, so I can't say how they are. But say I'm going into Lionsgate and I'm being like, this clause isn't working for me. And like 100 more people come in and say that, they're going to change it because filmmakers are becoming, it's like they're coming out of the dark. It's amazing.
Actually, what you just said gave me a great idea, because I want to take our collaborators, Facebook for Filmmakers thing, which I have to say I haven't devoted enough time to, and I need to cultivate it further. But I want to get like thousands of filmmakers signed up for basically, like, what if we got them all to say, you know what, this kind of clause in a contract we no longer accept.
Exactly.
You know? And we almost have like a bill of rights.
It's like a union.
Yeah. Like, I'm feeling like a new business.
We just had a union show.
Well. Yeah, we did. Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's a great idea. Because I mean, if there were certain kinds of provisions that were just deemed unacceptable, and if you had enough good filmmakers say no, things would shift.
Absolutely.
I mean, at the end of the day, mm-hmm. without the content,
these people have nothing
to do.
Right.
Exactly. There's true. No money stream without your film.
Back to real quick, before we move on to talking about your book, I just wanted to ask another sales agent question, if you don't mind. Filmmakers, is it better for filmmakers, going back to the sales agent kind of role as you in your former life? do filmmakers just send a film screener like a blind hit, or do they try to set up a meeting? What's the best? What would you advise
them? The blind hit thing is really bad. I mean, it's always best to find somebody you know who knows. Like, it's always best to get a referral or to have a connection. And certainly, you know, people really rely on email too much. It's everyone's over. I have 8,000 something unread emails. I'm not even exaggerating. I wish I were. I mean, there are a lot of them or newsletters or whatever, but you know, it's just like, it's, you gotta be strategic. I think again, filmmakers can get lazy. I mean, they'll just be, oh, I'm just going to blind email like 400 people. And you know, everyone on the receiving end of that knows that they can tell. So you've got to be a little bit more boutique about it and a little bit more structured and, you know, and basically you've got to sell your film to the sales agent first.
Well, it's funny because I just had this thought.
If you want to,
you wouldn't cast you know, an 80-year-old woman in the role of the ingenue, why would you expect to go to a Warner Brothers when your film is better at, you know, a Samuel Goldwyn? It just doesn't make sense to me. So why would you not put the same amount of effort and time and thought and research into selling your film as you do into casting your film?
Well, I think the director's hope or producer does that. And I think for smaller films, sometimes the director is the producer, but it's hard. It's, you know, because they're artists and because unfortunately the medium requires this business thing that they, it's hard for them.
Well, I think it's just also primarily ignorance. They don't know much about it. So they're just kind of like throwing stuff at the canvas, seeing what will stick. They know, I mean, they can, you get a direct response from who's in your movie because you can see them on screen.
Right.
And obviously, you know, it's like, oh, okay, that's working. That's not working. But as far as selling the movie, I'm imagining most newer filmmakers don't have much. I mean, I think filmmakers are getting more savvy, and I think you're kind of saying that as well, but you know,
I think they have to. The truth is now the whole mythology around, you know, going to a market or a festival and having your film picked up and you know, that's just changed. I mean, you know, it took a big dip, but there was a little bit of a resurgence, but not much. So people know now. Yeah. It's like, it's not going to happen.
And it sounds like your organization is the most amazing resource, and I'm definitely excited to check it out.
Definitely.
And we're going to cross post, obviously, awesome. Your website and stuff on our
thank you.
Website. Yeah. But I'm just super stoked to hear about it. And I'm excited to research myself. And
I'm excited. And I'm glad to be at this fabulous professional setup here. Can I just say, but the legal thing, we actually work with four law firms.
Oh, okay.
All who make money and that none of it comes to us. But we do, I will say, you know, our legal counsel is Sherry Song at a big firm called McGuire Woods. And so I will just say, like, you know, before you hire an attorney, like, we're also vetting attorneys and vetting firms and trying to help filmmakers get good legal services that are not astronomical and crazy.
Right.
No, that's so a wonderful service.
That's a huge service. Right,
I meant end to end. We're really going for it. And by the way, we're now compiling an E&O package for any film.
And just so everybody who's listening, E&O means errors and omissions. And when I made my first film, I had no idea, and it's expensive.
And so we're working on getting, about it. Because we're nonprofit, we're able to get our members lower rates.
Nice.
We're also getting people discounts at post production houses. So we're truly trying to be like from beginning to end, end to end, anything related to when your film is shot. After that,
it's very cool.
Sign up for a film collaborative membership right now. I think
I know.
Do it.
Oh. Can I do it online?
Count
if
my pennies.
If you were...
Yes, of course. Filmcollaborative.org.
If you could say anything to newer filmmakers out there who haven't been through this distribution process, now's your chance. What would you say?
Well, the first thing is, there's so much competition out there. You must be original. You must be fresh. And you must not be lazy and rush through your filmmaking. Not to say anyone's lazy. But I think it costs money and then there's exhaustion. And it's like, do not stop until you feel like you have the best film you could possibly have. Because seriously, it's going to have to be that for it to have any chance. And then think about your audience well before, like while you're making it, before you, all that
while
stuff.
While you're reading the script.
Yeah, and start to do that work and start to build community around your film and to get clear. And think about the marketing from the beginning, because that's what's going to set it apart, and that's what's going to help you. Even if you end up selling your rights, just having that community, those fans, and that clarity around the audience, and some vision around the marketing and what works and what does, and all that stuff, and having done it is going to help you A, have a better shot at those sales, and B, have the whoever's handling the distribution have a better shot at reaching the audience and all that stuff. So, you know, you really need to think about it sooner than later. And in the book, in Selling Your Film Without Selling Your Soul, you know, there's examples of it going both ways. Where there's the thought in time and doing it really well, and the mistake of not thinking about it till later and what that cost.
So the book was released in September.
Yes.
Tell us about your co-authors and kind of how the whole project came about.
Sure. It's a film collaborative project. We brought on John Reese, who's a filmmaker and professor and an author as well of his book, Thinking Outside the Box Office. We brought on
That book.
Yeah, it's a great book.
So good.
And Sherry Candler, who's, you know, his social network marketing strategist and guru, as well as ours, as well as for many other folks and filmmakers, and, you know, God bless. And she's amazing. And she's our co-author. And so we each of the three entities wrote, you know, a bunch of stuff in the book and covered. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, she wrote a chapter very focused on piracy and monetizing piracy and P2P. And John wrote about Note by Note and Best and the Brightest and Ride the Divide, and also an introductory chapter. And then we wrote about Adventures of Power and Bill American Bill Hicks story, and also a whole chapter on niche films where we cover a lot of different films that are niche. So
so readers of your book who haven't read it yet, which they should, what can they expect to get out of it?
So all those films I listed and some others that I didn't list yet, they can expect to see a full range of success stories and also warnings of, you know, what to do and not to do related to DIY distribution, hybrid distribution, P2P distribution, sales in all
That's
media,
awesome.
And details, real details, like deal, numbers and details and you know, vendor names and you know, all
wow,
that stuff.
Wow, that's unheard of.
It's never been done before, I tell you
that's
that.
That's amazing.
It's never been done. And let me also just say about the formats. So in the month of September, though it'll be too late for these people listening, the book is free. Then,
what?
Yeah. You better tell your folks now.
I want this book.
It's a
great book.
It's a multi-format digital book. So the enhanced version on iTunes will have video interviews of the filmmakers. The other formats,
wow,
like on Nook, which is a Barnes & Noble's format, and Amazon's Kindle, and the regular iBook will just, you know, be digital books without the interviews, the video. Actually, it might be the case that soon Amazon and Nook can support the video, so they might all have the videos anyway. Then there's going to be a printed book. So free in September, then $4.99 for the digital versions.
Mm. Wow, you guys, goodness. Seriously, $5 for this book?
And then $20 for the
Please
printed.
Please go buy it.
You have to buy it today. Stop and what you're doing right now, whatever you're doing, unless you're driving.
Get your copy.
Pull over to the side of the road.
Link on our website.
Get your iPhone out, and you can order it on your iPhone. You can download it right to the iTunes store.
There you go. You
it's
guys are
brilliant.
Good.
That's amazing.
Wow.
So we'll link it on our website for sure. That's
and the website, yeah, sellingyourfilm.com, is the website for the book.
Okay.
Oh, good to know.
Sellingyourfilm.com.
Got it. Cool.
But you can also find it on thecollaborative.org, of course. The filmcollaborative.org, sorry. What's my website?
There's so many more questions I'd like to ask you about the book, but we're running out of time. I can't ask you one, though. I'll ask you one question. The book goes into detail about budgets and revenues. Was that difficult to get out of filmmakers, that information?
Most filmmakers are really thrilled to be transparent. There are times when they can't be because either an investor issue or a corporate policy. So we got a lot of details and a lot of numbers. And there were times when, because of those other things, we had to estimate or something was left out. So, you know, but the filmmakers who participated were, of course, by and large, very eager and able to be transparent. And then there were other folks who didn't participate because they couldn't be.
Hmm.
They just couldn't.
And it's all in your contract. So make sure you read the contract before you start talking about numbers and stuff.
Well, we're going to wrap it up here. Orlie, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you so much.
So informative. Oh, my gosh.
Amazing.
And you thought the
so
hour would
knowledge.
Just drag by, but no. We knew.
Thank
we
you.
Knew
it's been great.
This is
lovely to be here.
Yeah, this is one of my favorites, for sure.
Do you have any social networks of your own, or I guess you can promote Film Collaborative at this point, or anything else you'd like to promote?
Film Collaborative, and we're on Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff. Any other social networks, like in life?
If you'd like to promote those, it's totally up to you.
No, I hate LinkedIn. I'm just going to say that right out loud.
I don't use it. I don't
LinkedIn,
use LinkedIn.
One of our sponsors, not anymore.
Joking.
Just kidding.
I don't know. Google Plus, I'm going to take the tutorial.
Oh, it's awesome. I've been on there for 3 weeks now. Really liking it.
I think
it's
we should
cool.
form one ourselves.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sure it'll just take a couple hours out of the year.
Perfect. Let's just
We're
do that
smart.
Right now. Okay.
Linda Lopez, do you have anything you'd like to share or... No? Okay, that face is going to... telling me no.
Same old stuff, you know. Completed a short film, and now we're in post-production.
Awesome.
So, good times.
Good times. There's the song.
We have a worldwide shorts app.
Ooh.
So
now I'm excited.
But you should... See, the thing is, a filmmaker like you with a short, I would say connect them to other shorts filmmakers who have a short that relates to similar audiences and make an app. 90 countries you can be in.
Oh, my gosh.
I like you, Orly.
We're going to do another episode with you, Orly.
Okay.
Please come back. Jenna Edwards.
I love you.
Please send your questions. I'm going to speak for Jenna because she's a little overwhelmed right now. Please send your questions, any question about filmmaking, to info@film-method.com. And Jenna will answer your questions in the Film Method mailbag. You can find us at Twitter, @FilmMethod, and also on Facebook, Film Method, of course. And our website is www.film-method.com. You can listen to all of our episodes there. We have a plethora of episodes. And, oh my gosh, 1,000th Facebook follower will get 2 hours free consultation with Jenna Edwards. So please follow us on Facebook.
That is a prize you want to win.
2 hours.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell
you. I want to win it. I'm going to sign up right now.
All about
click, 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 click.
What I know.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. Thanks everybody for listening, and please stay tuned for more great pod shows.
Pod shows
on Indie 100 and Film Method, film-method.com. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.